This talk was given by Charles Kay from Florida as he spoke at the 4th Florida Regional Convention of Narcotics Anonymous in 1985.
I'm Charles and I'm an addict. Before I get started, I'd like to say one thing, and that's anything I say tonight from this podium is my experience, strength, and hope. It's the way I work my program, and it's the thing that's kept me clean for over 6.5 years. Thank you. Thanks, Jim. You didn't have to lie so much in the introduction. That's the first time I've ever been introduced as somebody who goes after life like receiving a gift. And thanks. I have a tendency, usually when I speak, to start off saying I'm just like every other drug addict. And my wife brought it to my attention the other day that I am really not like your average drug addict. You know, my early life and, you know, in my using days, I wasn't like the average person who used drugs. From as early as I can remember, I wanted to be a drug addict. I'm serious. I mean, I had an older brother who was a dope fiend, hoodlum, ex-convict, and I wanted to be exactly like that. And from as early as I can remember, I robbed, I stole, I got high, I did everything he did. And my ultimate goal in life was to be exactly like him, standing on the corner, on the nod, a couple whores hanging on his arm, you know, and a pistol in his belt. That was my big ambition in life, was to achieve that. And I'm here to tell you I achieved it. You know? I was a success. I achieved that, and I achieved a lot more that I didn't bargain for. I was a heroin addict from the age 12 on. And I tried other drugs just to try them. But I always went back to the sure thing. Heroin, Dilaudids, things of that nature. And I don't know, I look back and I try to decipher what was going on and what were some of the motives and what were some of the things that led me to keep using. And it's hard for me to piece together. By the time I was 14, I was hospitalized with severe hepatitis. I was dying. And that was the first time anybody ever confronted me about my drug use. They told me I had to stop using all drugs or I was going to die. And that really didn't impress me at all. Laying in the hospital bed, recovering from hepatitis, I was getting high. I was having friends come in, bring me shots of dope. And it was like, I'm 14 years old, you know? I'll quit when I get old. Right now I'm young, I can't die. Things are working out all right. So what, I'm a little sick, I'm yellow, you know, no big deal. And I continued getting high. My parents were like middle class parents. They pretty lame, they weren't too hip to what was going on. They kind of had been through the mill with my older brother and figured, you know, we'll just deny everything that's going on and make believe that this really isn't happening twice, you know? Because I was doing it. My brother is still doing 2 life sentences, and he's been there for over 20 years. And I was following right in his footsteps. From the time I was 9 or 10 years old, I was in juvenile halls, in and out, always getting busted for something. Truant officers always coming to my house. The school always calling my house and my parents wanting to know, what is wrong with this kid? How come he's beating up on the other kids? How come he's like cussing the teachers? And, you know, they'd always ask me them questions, what's wrong? I don't know. And I didn't know. It's like, I didn't fit in. I never felt like I fit in. I literally lived on the other side of the tracks and went to a private school in an upper middle class suburbia, you know, where everybody's mom and dad drove them up to school in a little station wagon. and me and one other guy used to walk from literally the other side of the tracks where the projects were, the ghetto, and go to school every day. I'm a half-breed Indian, and that seemed to cause problems with me, where I didn't have like a true identity. I wasn't a white Anglo male. I wasn't an Indian. I wasn't Hispanic, and I wasn't black. You know, it's like I always ended up being the other. You know, that was like the only thing that I could identify with. Out of, you know, the choices I had was the other. Explain, you know. So I'd explain, you know, why I'm an other. And you know, I have to look back, you know, from like kindergarten on. That's the pattern my life was taking. Explain why you're an other, and you know, try to make people understand why you don't feel comfortable where you are. And it got to the point that when I'd get real loaded and when I'd go on the nod, that was the best escape. I could just sleep, wake up, shoot some more dope, go back on the nod. I didn't have to deal with anything. The most I had to deal with was a connection. And in the end, I didn't even do with that, you know? It was like, go get the drugs, rob them, beat them up, do whatever you have to do, get high, or attempt to get high, shoot large quantities of dope and wonder what's going on, how come it isn't working anymore. And the last, I look back about the last 6 years I shot dope, I didn't get high. I shot dope just to function in society, to be able to talk, to be able to walk, to be able to, you know, put my clothes on. That's all it amounted to. And I shot dope daily, every day, as much as I could put in my body. And an average of 3 times a week, I'd cop a nod for more than 5 or 10 minutes. And I wasn't doing a lot of bunk dope, you know. I wasn't getting ripped off every time I went to the connection. There was something inside of me that just wasn't working anymore. My addiction took me to prison 3 times. It's taken me around the world. You know, I've had the pleasure and the pain of shooting dope all around the world. I've been in and out of jail so many times that I can't even count anymore. And it amazes me when I look back at, you know, why didn't they ever just lock me up, throw away the key, and do me a favor? Because every time I got busted, it saved my life. I cleaned up for an average of a week till I made the county jail, got back with my old buddies, and started shooting dope again. And would stay shooting dope until they released me and I went back on the streets. The same way in prison, I got high all the way through my prison terms. And it was like the last time I went to prison was a turning point for me. I got out of the joint and I made a commitment to myself that enough's enough. I was, oh, I guess 24 years old, and I was getting tired of doing life on the installment plan. I'm serious. From the time I was 18, I was out of prison a total of maybe a year and a half. The rest of the time I spent behind bars, from here to Germany. And it was all behind drugs, or things to get drugs. And I got sick and tired of it. I said, this is it, enough's enough. If I have to get a job, I'll get a job, you know. If I have to not ride my motorcycle, I'll even put it in the garage for a month or two, you know. I'll actually be a citizen. I'll keep my hair cut, I'll shave, I'll, you know, clean my act up and try to get the heat off of me. And I did that. I got out of prison. I went and lived with old mom and dad, got a job, kept my hair cut, kept my motorcycle in the garage, bought a car, went to work every day like a good little boy, and got high on the weekends. You know? That's what it was all about. You know, we won't shoot dope during the week. Come Friday, we'll go get shit-faced. You know, spend the paycheck, and go back and go to work Monday. And I did that for like, 6 or 7 months. I did that till a buddy of mine got out of prison and gave me a call and said, come pick me up. And it was strange. The day I picked him up, we went to the connection. And it's like, I'd already made all these connections and was like dibble-dabbling around. Went to the connection and ended up staying there for a week. Did not leave. I'm serious. I pulled up at his door, bought some bags, and then a week went by. You know? I hadn't left his couch except to go to the kitchen to get more water to cook up, you know? Back to the couch in the living room, shoot, not out. And it was all started over again, you know? Here I was, back in the rat race again, shooting dope every day, all day long. Every time I'd get my little 15-minute break at work, it was in the bathroom, do a few bags, go back outside, go back to work. And I kept that up for a few more months, shooting dope every day, going to work every day, maintaining. Outward appearances is, you know, things were all right. And inside, I was dying. You know, I was like shaking my head and saying, not the same old shit again. I was back to robbing and stealing. I was back to doing any little petty crime I could do that I thought I could get away with, that, you know. And I was in a state where I'd already been a two-time loser. And the law was if I got arrested for anything else, I was facing a life sentence for a habitual criminal. And that started getting my attention. I started thinking, you know, I'm getting ragged here. I'm strung out. I'm desperate again. I'm starting to think about doing robberies of savings and loans again, you know, to get a quick buck. I've stolen everything that was convenient to steal, and it ain't doing it. I better go back on the methadone program so that, you know, at least it's cheaper. You know, I'll give them my $13 a week, go get my dose in the morning, and shoot dope in the afternoon, you know. Save a little money there. At least I won't have to shoot dope till noon, you know. And I figured I can do this. It makes logical sense, you know. I can still work at my job and pay for my drugs. And I went to look for a clinic to get on, and they all told me there was a 6-week waiting list. And there were 2 clinics in the city I was in, and I freaked out. That's the first time I'd ever been to a clinic where they told me, come back in 6 weeks. Most of them, you know, you showed them your tracks, sniveled a little bit, told them you were sick, and they give them the money and they gave you a dose, you know, no questions asked. And you could go down to the other clinic, get on it too, you know, and run a parley there. And I started freaking out. I started getting real desperate. I started getting real desperate when they started telling me 6 weeks. And I asked them, I said, well, what am I supposed to do? Are you telling me to go back out here and shoot dope for 6 weeks? And then, you know, you'll give me a call? Right, you know? Sounds real good. By this time, I was not living with mom and dad anymore. I was living with an alcoholic woman and her speed freak sister. 4 kids, a few animals, you know? It was a deep, meaningful relationship, you know? We were all in love with each other. I was working daily. They were working daily. We were all getting high every night. I'm on the nod, this one's lushed out, and the other one's speeding her brains out, you know? And I'm trying to think of, who am I going to get romantic with tonight, you know? Another day. And it was like, you know, it's funny now, because I remember I brought them all to my mother's house one day. Like, all proud, you know, look, Mom. Like you to meet so-and-so and so-and-so, and here's the kids, and ain't I doing so good? My mother told me, never, ever bring another woman to my house. Don't come back, you know? Leave. Thank you for sharing, you know? Get out of here. And it's like, I immediately copped an attitude, you know, that would end all attitudes, you know? Don't she know anything? You know, what's going on here? Nah, cussing them. Being a real asshole, and it's like, you know, never once, so blind to what was going on that it was impossible for me to see anything. And I went to this methadone clinic on a Friday. I took off work Friday to go on the clinic. So Monday when I went into work, my boss confronted me and said, where were you Friday? Like any good addict, I made up a nice, you know, elaborate lie and figured that'll end the problem right there, you know. About an hour later, he called me back into his office and he says, Charles, you're lying. Where were you? And this was the first person in my whole life to ever confront me. He was the very first person to ever call me out on my shit and say, you're lying. Through my years of growing up, I gained a reputation as being quick-tempered, insane, and it was good reason. I always carried a gun, and I was real quick to shove it down your face, shoot you, stab you, pistol whip you. I'm talking about my friends. You know, if I didn't know you, forget about it, you know. You were in serious trouble. And I was that way. I'd get loaded, and then all of a sudden I'd just snap, be pistol whipping the guy sitting next to me, thinking he was ripping me off or something, you know, knocking his teeth out. And needless to say, nobody ever confronted me too much, you know. People just kind of ignored me, put up with my shit, and left me alone, gave me lots of space, and let me isolate, let me live by myself. The women that were living with me, they never said a word to me because I'd do the same thing to them. It didn't matter. Anybody who would try to test me on anything, I would like put them in their place in my own mind. I would seriously hurt them physically. And then I figured if I do that, then they'll get the idea to leave me alone. I don't want any friends. I don't want anybody hanging around me. All I want to do is shoot dope. Can you understand that? You know, it was like a desperate cry inside of me, yelling out to the world at large, leave me alone, let me shoot dope. I won't hurt you, you know. I'll only steal a little bit from you, you know. And I'll try to be, somewhat of a nice guy. All I want to do is shoot dope, stay in this motel, you know, watch the cockroaches and nod out. That's it. You give me that, and I'd be in heaven. And it was like, it never worked out that way. There was always something queering up the deal. You know, if it wasn't work, it was having to steal more than usual, or the connection would give me a hassle, or something like that. And for some reason, when my boss confronted me, before I could even think or contemplate what was going on, I told this guy I was a junkie, and I was looking to get on the clinic. And the minute the words came out of my mouth, I got fear and paranoia like I never felt in my life. Where I was living in Texas, you got busted for having tracks on your arms. And I had tracks over my whole goddamn body. And I immediately thought, this guy's gonna call the police, I'm gonna lose my job, I'm going to jail, I see a life sentence flashing in front of me, I'm freaking out, I'm fidgeting in his office wondering, you know, should I go to my locker and just shoot this sucker right now and get out of here? What's going on? You know, it's like total freak out. And he goes, Charles, do you really want help? I go, yeah, look at me. And it was like a moment of truth, you know. I had hair down in the middle of my back. I was about 40 pounds lighter than I am right now. We're talking Grim Reaper in motion right here. My face was sunk in. My eyes look like raccoons, you know. I look like these kids they're doing all these concerts for, you know. And it's like, I was in bad shape. And the sick thing was, is in my own mind, I thought I looked good. Yeah, you know. I'd like go, say I'm going to go on hunt for women tonight, you know, and I'd go to some bar, do a bunch of dope, stand in the back and nod, and look cool, you know, and wait for one of them to ask me home. No one asked me. I went home, shot more dope, and life was fine, you know. And it's like I could never see myself for what was really going on, you know. I was so blind to my own reality. It was pathetic. And if anybody ever pointed it out to me, I got violent with them. Don't mess with my little fantasy. And my boss told me I could go to a detox. He told me I could have sick leave. He told me I wouldn't lose my job. They'd pay me. And immediately the paranoia left. Immediately the fear left. Immediately the big sigh of relief came. And it wasn't for getting help. It was for the heat's off of me again. I'll go to this little detox, you know, keep my mouth shut, lay up for a week, eat, you know, do whatever drugs they give me there. Because every place I'd ever been gave you drugs. You know, if it was some kind of, you know, Motowns, Uptowns, Ellavilles, Trivilles, Xvilles, you name it, some kind of weird naming thing. They'd give you a handful, take these, don't shoot no dope, everything will be fine. And I figured that is another routine of this. So I went to this detox. It happened to be out of state. I said, no problem. I'll go there. I did drugs all the way to the detox. Got there. First day I was there, I immediately asked the nurse for something to help me with my detox. You know, I knew I was going to be ill. And I was serious. I was doing a 30-pill script of Dilaudid and a 30-pill script of Demerol daily. This was daily and more if I could get extra scripts. But that was a minimum. I had that in the bag every day, and extra if I could get it. And I'd been doing that for about 9 months straight. So I knew I was going to have a nice little habit to kick here. And it wasn't going to be fun. And, you know, I was going to be sick, and I figured any little help I can get will be fine. I know they're not going to give me enough to take it all off, but they ought to give me something, you know. The nurse gives me a vitamin, takes my blood pressure, gives me an orange juice with honey in it, and says, don't worry, we have a doctor on call. And I started freaking out then. I go, come on, aspirin, how about some Librium, you know. I'll even take a few codeines, you know, Tylenol number threes. Come on, something, you know. She goes, don't worry, it'll be all right, you know, we're watching you. And for 7 days in this detox, all I did was I kicked my habit. Ate vitamins, got my blood pressure took, and drank orange juice with honey in it. And at the end of 7 days, they had some kind of doctor in this place. I don't know what kind he was, if he was a psychiatrist, psychologist, what the hell he was. But apparently he had been looking at me this week. Because he come up to me on the Friday and he goes, Charles, I think you need to go to a halfway house. I said, yeah, you're probably right. If you send me back to Texas, I'm going straight to the connection. Because every ounce of my body, every ounce of it, was telling me, enough's enough, let's go get some Dilaudid. Come on, Charles. Enough of this doing that nothing bullshit. We need some drugs. And it was a literal voice in my head, 24 hours a day, all the time. You know, it was like just back there saying, come on, let's go. Enough of this bullshit. We need some drugs. Let's go home. It's been nice. Let's go. Come on. And I said, okay. I said, I'll go to the halfway house. He goes, there's only one catch. I go, what's that? He goes, it's in Nebraska. I said, fine. Let's go. I went to this halfway house. I'm in Nebraska. I'd never, ever been to Nebraska. And I know why, you know. Absolutely nothing there. Doug, that's why you're down here now. I'm at this place. The day I get there, it starts snowing. And I'm from the South. I'm from Texas. I'd seen snow maybe four times in my life. The day I get off the airplane, it starts snowing. I'm wondering, what kind of miserable existence have I gotten myself into? The little voice is telling me, okay, Charles, we need drugs. And I'm like wondering, why am I even here, you know? I don't know anybody. It's cold. It's snowing. I want drugs. And I'm in Omaha, Nebraska. Something ain't right, you know? I was like real confused as to what was going on, you know? it's like my logic definitely wasn't working anymore. And the day I went into this halfway house, and this guy's walking around asking people if they want to go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. He's signing us up to go out the next day. And he walks up to me and introduced himself, and he goes, "Charles, do you want to go to the NA meeting?" I said, "What's an NA meeting?" He goes, "Narcotics Anonymous." I said, "Sign me up." I had absolutely no idea what Narcotics Anonymous was about. I heard one word, narcotics. And I honestly thought that this was some place to come and make a connection. And I was so freaked out and depressed when I got there. It's like, the only way I can relate it is that feeling when you just got a pocket full of money, you talk to the connection, he's home, and he's got the dope. And you're on your way over there. You know that elated feeling you had? Boy, you were stepping high. No more depression. Boy, you were whistling. You know, even pet the dog if he come up to you, you know? Everything's fine, you know? You're whistling. You know things are going to be all right in just a few minutes. And that's the way I felt. I knew that come tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, everything was going to be fine. Everything was going to be great. I wasn't going to have to listen to this little voice anymore. I wasn't going to feel like shit no more. Things were really going to be good. Next day rolls around. I'm like wanting us to go early, you know? Hey, it's 7 o'clock. Ain't time to go yet. The place was like maybe 8 or 10 blocks away from where the house was. And I go to this meeting. There was maybe 15, 20 people there. And I immediately start looking around to see who's got what. I was looking for outwardly appearances that I could identify with. And what I identified with was long hair, Harley Davidson t-shirts, motorcycle boots, and dungarees. That's it. Or real sleazy women. You know, either one was fine. Anything but that, I really didn't identify with. I figured you were a narc, you know, probably a snitch, you know, didn't have any good connections anyway, or you wouldn't be the way you were. No, really, everybody I knew had good dope looked real sleazy, you know. You were so strung out, you couldn't afford nothing else. You know, it was common sense. And I go sit down by this guy who had long hair, beard, had a motorcycle shirt on. And I figured, oh, I know he's cool. He's bound to have something. And I'm sitting there, and they open the meeting up, read from the white book. And I'm waiting. And they're doing a topic discussion, and I'm waiting. And I'm looking, wondering, when are they going to break at least a joint out, you know? I was not a pot smoker, but I figured, you know, they ought to at least be passing a joint around or something, you know? And I nudge this guy, and I ask him, I go, "Hey, when are they going to break the narcotics out?" I go, "This is Narcotics Anonymous, isn't it? Where's the narcotics?" And he looked at me and he smiled. And he goes, "Keep coming back, it gets better." I immediately looked at him like he was speaking a foreign language to me. I figured he'd been out there 10 minutes too long. It was a burnout. And I started looking around at the other people then that I couldn't identify with, figuring maybe they, being it was Nebraska, they probably had the dope, you know? So I'm sitting here through this whole meeting. No drugs. I'm starting to get depressed. And then they get up to do the chips. So my great genius says, "This is it. You got to get one of these little chips to show them you're cool. You know, you're not a snitch. Then they'll make a connection with you, you know. They're just not going to let anybody off the street cop, you know. I can understand this." So they ask if there's any newcomers, and I immediately raise my hand. Walked up there, got my chip, I had no, you know, I hadn't heard anything this whole meeting about you don't have, no, not using drugs or, you know, making commitments to yourself or what this white chip was about. I'm like already racing. Now they know I'm cool, now I can make the connection, everything's still going to be fine, I was happy again. And the guy who gave me my chip said a few things to me that impressed me and has stuck with me all this time.
Please turn this tape over as this talk is continued on side two.
He said, please come back because we need you. And that freaked me out. That was the very first person who had ever said they needed me. My family never said they needed me. No girlfriend I ever had said she needed me. The only time people needed me was to do a robbery or buy dope. Nobody, for no reason at all, ever said they needed me. And he asked me to come back. And I immediately got paranoid then. It's like, what do they want from me? You know, what are they trying to get at? Like I really had something, you know. Had about 6 shirts, a few pair of pants, one little bag, and that was it. My life possessions in it, you know, and a few dollars in my pocket. And the thing that I guess really snagged me was after the meeting, this young lady asked me to go out for coffee, and we ended up at her house. And I figured, this is great, you know. I never had it so easy. I got laid, and I said, I'm coming back, you know. What the hell? I kind of liked some of the people then. Figured Nebraska wasn't too bad. And I asked the guy that was head of our halfway house if we could have an NA meeting at it. There was another guy in the house with me that had like a few days less clean time than me. And we were the ones who had the bright idea of let's start a meeting. We had an AA meeting at the house, and we figured, what the hell, we can have an NA meeting. And me and this guy started a meeting. Now, at that first meeting I'd went to, I thought I'd stolen a white book. I didn't know it was for free. So I eased up on the old table where the stuff was sitting in, right in the old pocket, you know. Figured I'd pick up whatever I could that was laying around. And his head was a little more together than mine. He knew they read from it. So I said, well, I got one. Now, neither one of us knew what you read, so we figured, well, let somebody who's not inside the halfway house do the reading. They'll know what to read. So this was like a Wednesday night was the night I went to that meeting, and that Friday night we started the meeting. And we didn't know what was going on. Somebody said something about you got to have secretaries and treasurers, and he said, I'll be one. I said, I'll be the other. You know, we got all this covered if that's all you have to do, and we'll go for it. And that was like my first introduction to service, was that right there. And it hasn't stopped. I had nothing but a hard time the whole time I was in that halfway house. For one simple reason, I couldn't understand what take direction means. I couldn't learn from your experience, strength, and hope. I had to go through it. And I was here to not go to prison, to get the heat off of me, and to lay back, you know, hang out. I didn't have nothing better to do. I didn't come here with an honest desire to stop using. I didn't even want to stop using for like the first 90 days or so. I just came around here because it was convenient. I really didn't have anything or any other place to go. You know, I was real burnt out. And this is one of the few places where people appeared to be happy to see me. You know, I couldn't swear to it, but at least they put on a good front. They smiled. They always came up and shook my hand. You know, they didn't talk to me too much. and I don't blame him, I didn't have much to say. I had one of these real bad attitudes. I was very spaced out. The first, like, probably year, I was clean. I'd go to meetings, I'd smile at people, tell them, why don't you die, you know, drop dead, you know, go screw yourself, you know. And I wasn't doing it to get attention. I wasn't doing it to be a comedian. I meant it. I didn't like them, you know. Get out of my face, don't touch me, don't talk to me. I didn't stand in a circle to pray for years. I carried a gun with me to meetings for over 2 years, just in case. Just in case somebody I'd done something to showed up. I wanted to be ready. I always sat, you know, the old attitude, back against the wall, where I had good view of what was going on. You weren't going to creep on me. I'm serious. If you walked up behind me and touched me, 9 out of 10 times I hit you. Out of just reflex. It didn't matter. I would knock your lights out and worry about it later. I had, you know, I was real into my image. And if you wanted that image, you didn't have nothing to say to me. If you want a biker, if you didn't have any of that lifestyle, and especially if you want some kind of addict that shot dope, forget it. I did not listen to you at all. If you were somebody that just did pills or pot or drank, don't even waste your time talking to me. Because I had absolutely no open mind. I had nothing to say to you. It's like, I knew I wouldn't hang out with you on the streets, and I definitely wasn't going to start hanging out with you now. That was my attitude, you know, and it's like, take it or leave it. I don't need y'all, was the kind of attitude I had. You can't kick me out of here. I learned that real fast, you know. I learned real quick that they couldn't throw me out. So I figured it was carte blanche, you know. I could do whatever I wanted to. I found out the people that I annoyed the most, and I'd make sure I sat next to them. Those are the ones I'd talk to, you know. Tell them I hope they had a bad day and stuff, you know. I wasn't real big on working steps. I wasn't into much of anything other than showing up, not using. And things got better just doing those two things. Things got better than they had ever gotten before in my life, by staying abstinent and showing up for meetings. And it got to a point where that just wasn't enough. The pains of my past and my present actions were catching up with me. The things I'd started, you know, old patterns I'd started doing in recovery were starting to tell, you know, tell their toll. And I was having to pay the price. The isolation was catching up to me again. I was sitting around wondering, out of all these people, how come only one person will sit and talk to me? And the reason was, that guy was as sick as I was. We were cohorts. And, you know, and then it got to the point where me and him were ready to fight. And that got my attention. It was like, something's not right here. My only friend, and he's, me and him are ready to throw down on each other. And it's like, to see who was the toughest, or who was the best, or, you know, some ridiculous thing. And I said, maybe I need to start doing something here. Early in my recovery, they told me this was a hip pocket program. At the time, our literature consisted of a white book and a couple other pamphlets. If you had the white book, you had every pamphlet except one. So you were covered if you had that. And they told me, you can take this thing, put it in your pocket, and carry it with you wherever you go. And I did that. I kept a white book with me for the first 2 years on a daily basis. Anytime I got jammed up, I pulled the white book out and I started reading it. And I'd read from cover to cover as many times as it took till the feeling to get high left. I'd stick it back in my pocket and I'd go on about my business. And I'd go to my meetings whenever the meetings were open. I moved from Nebraska down to Louisiana. And me and another guy got real active in NA down there. helping it grow. And we got real sick, too. It's like every day I stayed clean, I was an old-timer. I had the most clean time, and I knew the most about Narcotics Anonymous. And I created a nice little empire, as Charles sees it. And, pumped my ego all up, thought I had all the answers, and watched it cave in on top of me, and suffered the pain from that. Suffered the pain from having to totally leave that, and watch it go from X amount of meetings to zero meetings in a matter of a month. Because of one personality, mine, that should not have ever been there in the first place. I went through the trials and tribulations of being a fanatical traditions person. I'm talking fanatical. I would jerk you out of meetings if you talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. I would jump right up in front of everybody and tell you to shut up. That was against traditions. It isn't allowed here. If you're going to talk about it, get out. Yeah. And you know, I was wrong. I was wrong with my actions. But I still have them same principles inside of me today.
Right.
I don't put up with that shit. On a personal tone. I don't have to. I've gone to every kind of meeting there is to go to. And I go to this. And I come here because I come here to get my recovery. And somebody told me when I was real early in recovery that you got to put your eggs in one basket. Either God is everything or God is nothing. And either this program works or it doesn't. And I said, you're on. I accept the challenge. And at that time, there were two NA meetings a week in my city, and if I wanted an NA meeting a week, I had to drive about 80 miles each way, 2 days a week, and over 100 miles the other day a week to get a meeting. And me and my buddy did it. It was like, hey, no problem. What's the big deal about driving from here to New Orleans or from here to Lafayette? No problem. It's just a little, you know, a few bucks for gas. And I did that for like probably a year and a half. I made that little, you know, I had my little routine. One day here, next day New Orleans, next day Lafayette. Every now and then I'd get brave and go over to Mississippi, pick one up, you know. Well, yeah, and it was like, that's what you did, you know. It was like, not unusual. You didn't snivel about having to drive 20 minutes to a meeting, you know. It was like, what's the problem? A little road trip here, you know. And I made that commitment to myself, and I caught the heat behind it. Because 99% of my friends were going to both fellowships, you know? And they were real okay. They were fine. And they could not understand why I didn't want to do that, you know? How come you don't want to be one of the guys, Charles? And it's like, because I don't fit. I'm back to square one where I was my whole life, an other. And I don't have to be an other anymore, you know? You know, there's something in our tradition that touches me every time I read it, and it says, I am accepted for what I am, not in spite of. And I can only get that here. I can't get that from my family. I can't get that from a lot of people outside of these rooms. I have to come here to get it. Because you understand the pain I've gone through. You understand the turmoil, the decisions I've had to make in my recovery, the stands I've had to take, the positions I've had to take, the loneliness I've had to feel because of my decisions. Because, you know, the minute I made that decision, I lost all my friends, all of them. They immediately said, you're sick, you know. We can't get enough over here. we got to go over there. And I said, you're wrong, you know, and I'll prove it to you. I didn't have a sponsor, and I still don't. I had problems. I talked about them at meetings. I had questions. I asked. If I couldn't get the answer here, I called till I got the answer. I had phone numbers in California. I had phone numbers in other places in the country. And I used them when I got jammed up. And not once would my own ego and pride allow me to go back to them and say, I need help. I've got problems. It was it was an all or nothing thing. Either this program is going to save my life and do what this convention theme is, give me the gift of life, or I'm going to die. Real simple. And if I keep using, I'm going to die, so I have nothing to lose and everything to gain. And, you know, it amazes me to sit here, or stand here rather, and look out. I can remember going to world conventions where you take half of this room, and that's all there ever was. That was like, you know, 60% of the fellowship in the world. And there's people here who remember that, you know. And we're looking here that the majority of the people here are from Florida, you know. We've got more people in Florida now than that fellowship had when I first got clean. And it's like, I get frustrated, I get upset, I freak out, you know, over piddly little things today, you know, because people don't see things the way I see them. Don't they understand that this thing is a gift, but you got to put some work into it. You got to do some footwork. You got to make some sacrifices. You got to take some action. You know, it ain't about just hanging out and being cool. You know, it's about, for me, how much do I want out of life? Do I want all the benefits the book talks about? If I do, then I have a real simple plan to get them. I work the steps on a daily basis. I practice the principles in all my affairs, and I get the benefits. And I've gotten the benefits because I took the action. I've made the effort. I took the time to work the steps and incorporate them into my life. You know, you can talk about, God's going to help me, but I'm not going to be able to sit here and just say, hey, God, you know, here I am in Florida, and I'm ready for a miracle. You know, it don't happen like that for me. He gives me all the tools, he gives me all the equipment, and he gives me all the power I need on a daily basis to go out there, face the world, not having to use, and be the best person I can be. And the days that I'm not that, are the days that I choose not to do that. My higher power doesn't have any little games with me, you know, like, let's put him in this jackpot today, you know, watch him squirm, you know. And I hear people talk like that, you know, and it's like, I don't know, my higher power don't play games. He's all serious business, you know. He works for me. He don't work for none of y'all. You know, I'm his sole employer. I give him his paycheck, you know. He takes care of this addict. He does what's necessary for me to go one day without using drugs. And that's it. I can't buy no weekend package rate or, you know, get some like I did at the clinic. You know, I can't get a take-home shot, you know, from him. It's a daily thing. Every day I got to show up, be present for life, and let it happen. And I feel fortunate a lot of times that I got incorporated into that real early in my recovery. People told me that, you know, that 90% of it was showing up. And I've always been one of them people to show up and be present for life, you know, and learned how to, like, let life happen without fucking the system too much. Learned how to, you know, it's going to go this way. I either go with it or I fight it and feel like shit. And I got tired of fighting. I finally wised up and got enough common sense to see that when I went with the flow, My wife got better. I had friends. Things started going good. I wasn't in the middle of controversy, you know. It was like freaking me out. You know, it's like, it's been years since I've been in anything controversial. And I wonder what's wrong, you know? What's going on here? And it's because I don't choose to be controversial today. I've got opinions, I've got attitudes, and they're mine and they keep me clean. And that's all I'm worried about. If they help you, you can use them, you know? But I finally got to the point where I don't have to expect you to have the same attitudes and outlooks on life as I do. And about the first 3 years of my recovery, I did. I was so adamant and so gung-ho N.A. that I tried to force-feed it to everybody that walked in front of me. And I stayed frustrated, I stayed bent out of shape, I stayed, you know, totally exhausted, I stayed confused, I stayed in the middle of controversy. You know, there's still states around the country that will be real happy if I never come to them again, you know. And it's all because of my bad attitude in recovery, you know, and my bad action and my reaction to things that, even though I had great intentions, I had some real lousy actions, you know, and it took a long time for me to get honest with that stuff, you know. It's like for a long time I was able to walk around and say it's their problem, and if they would change, things would be okay. And it's the same attitude I had my whole life, you know. If life will give me a break, things will be fine, you know. So let me have my little corner, my mountain of drugs, a few new sets of works, everything will be fine, you know. And it's bullshit. It would have never been fine then, because I almost had that. You know, I've had buckets of dope, literally pails of dope with new sets of works, and it wasn't okay. That wasn't enough, you know. It's like I need more. And it's strange. Today I don't need more. It freaks me out sometimes. If nothing ever changed from this moment on, I'm satisfied. I finally reached a moment of peace in my life where it's okay today. My life is okay. I've got ups and downs like everybody else, but the basic substance of my life is so okay, I can live with it from now on. And the great part about it is I know that it ain't going to be that way. I know that as long as I show up, I know that as long as I keep working the steps, I know that as long as I do what's necessary for me, that it's going to get better. And I'm still a dope fiend at heart, you know. If you give me an inch, I'll take a mile. And you gave me a few of these benefits, and I came back for more. And you gave me some more. So I'm coming back for some more. And it's like they don't run out, you know. And that freaks me out. I keep waiting for, you know, it's kind of like getting to the limit, you know. It's like, okay, Charles, you've used them all up. This is it. You've always talked about being satisfied. Well, now I'm calling you out on it, you know. And it's like, I read in the book, and I talk to people that have been around a lot longer than me, and they all tell me the same thing, that it continually gets better, that the benefits are there, that this is the answer for the disease I have, and that all I have to do is keep showing up and keep working the steps. And the thing that makes me feel the best about the whole thing is I know that it can happen for everybody sitting in this room. There's no exceptions to the rule, you know. And it's a real simple task. If you don't pick up, you don't get high. If you just do that and you go to a meeting on a regular basis, things will get better than they've ever gotten for you. Now, you really want to freak out? Work the steps. You know? It's easy. You want to just totally freak out? Work the steps. Today, I'm at a point where I can learn from others' mistakes. I don't need to be in the jackpot anymore. and I also know that my defects are so outstanding in every area of my life that they'll never disappear, you know? They'll never be removed. They'll just be manipulated and altered to a workable acceptance, you know? I still get angry and freak out. I still, you know, get myself my self-pity. I still get my resentments. I still get my self-righteous indignation. And the great thing about it is it doesn't last for weeks, months, days. It lasts a few hours. I get real sick of it real quick. And I have a choice to change, and I make the choice, and I change. You know? Today I have the choice. Today I use it. And it didn't cost me anything. It was no great guru told me it, you know? I came to rooms with a few people as sick as I was, most of them less time than me, listened to what they had to say, and I got my answers, you know? I got the answers from the newcomers. And today I'm one of these people that have a hard time with newcomers. My patience and tolerance is like paper thin with newcomers. And it's because I'm so sensitive to people, and I want everybody to have it like I've had it. I've never relapsed. And to tell you the truth, I'm not. I don't have a reason to. I have the choice today, and I don't have to. And it's like I want a guarantee on every newcomer that comes in that they're not going to relapse. And I know I can't get it, and I stay away. Because the pain of people coming in and out, in and out, in and out, it hurts. It hurts worse than my addiction hurt. And I don't deal with that real good. So I avoid it, you know? It's kind of like you stick your hand in the fire and you get burned. You don't stick your hand in the fire. I don't stick my hand in the newcomer's face too often. I sit back, I share my experience, strength, and hope, and then when they've been around 6 months, 9 months, a year, I start sticking my hand out. I figure maybe they got a chance. Maybe it's catching for them. And even then, I'm leery. You know, even then, I'm leery. I'm still a very isolated person. I have a few friends. I tell you, there's thousands of people know me. They'll call me by my name, hi, how you doing? And 99% of them I don't know. I see their face. I have absolutely no idea where they're from, what their name is, you know, how long they've been around. You know, it's weird. If you haven't had, like, over a few years clean time, chances are I don't remember your name. And it's like my own way of dealing with uncomfortable things is like I'll totally block it right out. That way, if I get the news that, oh, so-and-so OD'd, I don't have to feel bad about that. It's like, this is what happens sometimes, you know? And I can deal with that pain that way. And it's, you know, maybe that'll change for me someday. Maybe it don't need to. Because I know I'm not the only one who has to stick his hand out to newcomers today. I know I don't have to be like I thought I had to be in Louisiana, king of Narcotics Anonymous. I don't have to have all the answers. I don't have to be there for every addict. The main thing I have to do is not use, go to meetings, and work the steps for Charles. If I can do that, I'm a great success. And everything else will take care of itself. And all I have to say in closing is that I hope that I see all these faces next year, you know? But I also know that it ain't gonna happen that way. Sounds real good. Real cutesy, you know, rah-rah, but the reality is it ain't going to be that way. And the faces I'm looking at today may not be here tomorrow, you know? And that sucks. I don't like that. I don't deal with that too good. But I know that for today, I'm going to be here. And only here. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this talk by Charles Kay. Talks by other NA members can be obtained from the World Service Office at the address on the label.